To an enterprising Scot by the name of Douglas McRae, the FT's first managing director, who in 1893 ditched white newsprint in favour of the blushing pink, which you see today. Now, some might point to another built-in advantage for the Financial Times. We do deal in business and financial news, where accurate and insightful information is a commodity which consumers are willing to pay for. As our advertising slogan says, we live in Financial Times. But this does not do full justice, in my view, to the transformation which we've achieved at the FT and are still working to achieve, so we can prosper in the years ahead. So in practical terms, first we doubled the price of the newspaper on the retail stand in Britain, and we raised cover prices elsewhere around the world. And this sent a powerful signal to the market and to our own journalists that the FT is a premium product. Second, we rapidly developed our subscription business, both digitally on FT.com and in newspaper form, to reduce our dependence on advertising. That way, we also reduced our reliance on the casual purchaser in favour of the loyal subscriber. And we recast the debate on newspaper circulation in terms of a more meaningful definition of audience based on both print and digital consumers. Third, we swung firmly behind the principle of charging for content, using a meter model based on frequency of readership. And 4 years on, that meter model has proved to be an industry pioneer and an unequivocal success. The FT now has nearly 4 million registered users, a combined paid print and digital circulation of 585,000, and a combined print and online average daily readership of over 2 million people worldwide. No wonder other publications, notably the New York Times, are now adopting similar paid meter models, and by all accounts, they're meeting with success. Fourth, we abandoned or revised arrangements which allowed other news providers or aggregators to sell our content to third parties in return for them giving us a fee. In future, we determined we would sell direct to our customers and offer our distributors a licensing arrangement, and we would aggressively pursue any party seeking to circumvent our paywalls through cookies or sharing of passwords. Fifth, and lastly, we made sweeping editorial changes which complemented this commercial strategy. These were founded on the principle of the integrated newsroom, whereby all journalists were required to work both for the print and digital channels. And more than a decade later, we now have a fully flexible workforce, fully flexible news operation in which reporters and editors work seamlessly in print and online. There ends the commercial break. The FT approach does not necessarily lend itself to being adopted by others. We live in a time of great experimentation. Associated Newspapers, for example, which publishes the Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday, has enjoyed tremendous success with the free access model. Last month, Mail Online, with its arresting showbiz front page, became the second most visited website in the United States, with almost 37 million page views, surpassing the Huffington Post. And according to Associated, Mail Online is profitable, exploiting its worldwide reach to attract advertisers. Now, I'm often asked, how long can newspapers survive? My response is that the decline of the newspaper does not necessarily translate into the death of the newspaper. This is not, on my part, some kind of nostalgia or irrational fondness for dead trees. Print newspapers can still be profitable products. Many of our readers and advertisers still want them. And our journalists still know how to write and edit a great newspaper. And print advertising, whilst declining as a portion of revenues, is still a powerful engine. Moreover, new and more efficient forms of printing are springing up, which are less expensive than the industrial-style plant with gigantic and costly presses. The FT is now printing digitally in Cyprus, Malta, and soon Brazil. The quality of reproduction is good, and the distribution costs far cheaper than the traditional format. Our task, therefore, is to ensure that the newspaper evolves in step with the mobile and digital products. This means changing our traditional view of the newspaper as a constantly updated and tweaked summary of news and commentary produced in multiple editions throughout the night. In future, the newspaper will likely become an amalgam of the best and sometimes timeless content, whether news, analysis, or commentary. By contrast, the web product will increasingly serve as the form which produces, for want of a better phrase, the news now. It will be rawer and more immediate than the printed form. Editors are going to have to distinguish between high worth news and analysis, content that has to live on the web, and material that can be enriched and refined for a more cut out and keep, if you like, lasting form for print. In sum, the web will more likely adopt a broadcast mentality compared to its more considered cousin, the newspaper. Now, the FT is now engaged in translating some of these ideas into practice. We can learn lessons from others. The Svenska Dagbladet, is that right, Christina? Yeah. In Stockholm has propagated the notion of, it's intriguing, fast and slow journalism for the web and print. This newspaper now reserves a dedicated amount of space for deep and original reporting on matters of public interest, while reporting the news of the day is limited, barring an important breaking story. We live, as I said, in a period of great experimentation, and that leads me to today's great conundrum. However much the mainstream media on both sides of the Atlantic would like to separate themselves from the aggregators, bloggers, and associated purveyors of news, the fact is, we're all linked in a complex, symbiotic digital ecosystem, which has rendered national jurisdictions porous, if not at risk of being washed away. And this raises, in my view, serious regulatory issues. As Marcus Brockley noted in a Harvard lecture earlier this year, and I quote, "In the past, newcomer technologies coexisted with the media that came before. So television coexisted with radio, which coexisted with magazines and newspapers. Now, suddenly, we all inhabit the same digital realm." Yet coexistence does not mean that everyone is playing by the same rules, or indeed playing on the same field. In the US, leading newspapers such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post are committed to the separation of news and comment. They would all subscribe to C.P. Scott's dictum, "Comment is free, facts are sacred." Now, some may find this commitment to impartiality or impartial reporting quaint. Cynics would say it's a stretch. But my transatlantic colleagues take it very seriously. Indeed, unlike the British newsroom, the separation of news and comment is institutionalized. A managing editor is responsible for news coverage, while an editorial page editor is in charge of the op-ed page. The web insurgents have no such commitment to impartiality, let alone objectivity. On the contrary, Many take great delight in their partisanship and rumour mongering. As Nick Denton, a former Financial Times reporter and now New York-based founder of Gawker, motto, today's gossip is tomorrow's news. As Nick once told the Washington Post, we may inadvertently practice journalism, but that is not the institutional intention. New media often seems to want to walk on both sides of the fence. The new media people shun the label of journalist, but they're happy to use it as a badge of responsibility and respectability to hide their often deeply ideological agendas. And at the same time, so-called aggregators, such as the Huffington Post, depend, to a degree, on the work of the mainstream media for their own existence. Bill Keller, who's just stepped down as editor of the New York Times, put this rather well recently. I quote, aggregation can mean smart people sharing their reading lists, plugging one another into the bounty of the information universe. It kind of describes what I do as an editor. But too often, it amounts to taking words written by other people, packaging them on your own website, and harvesting revenue that might otherwise be directed to the originators of the material. In Somalia, this would be called piracy. In the media sphere, it's a respected business model. Now, both the Huffington Post and the Beast have lately invested in their journalism, building up investigative teams and a stable of top commentators. Both HuffPo and the Beast, now teamed up with Newsweek, have also broken cracking stories, the latest being the Beast's revelations that Facebook hired a West Coast public relations firm to smear Google. Good story. Yet neither can seriously match the deep and original reporting of the New York Times, say, in places like Afghanistan or Iraq. Of course, some would happily conflate the notion of the free press with access to free content. But this is a road to perdition. Serious journalism costs serious money. As one of my friends, a real wag, put it, journalism wants to be free. Journalists want to eat. We should move beyond the argument, however, just about aggregation and proprietary information. We need now to examine the implications of this new digital ecosystem that new media is increasingly moving into now, mainstream media's reporting space. And that brings with it, if they're coming onto our territory in effect, that brings with it responsibilities and raises the questions of a level regulatory playing field. The absence of such a level playing field was exposed during the controversy over super injunctions or gagging orders. While Twitter and other outlets were happily spreading the name of an errant footballer, the mainstream media was banned from mentioning the mere existence of the gagging order, let alone the name of the Lothario. Then a Scottish newspaper revealed his identity, that is, apart from his eyes. That was censored. And he was also named in Parliament as Manchester United's roving left wing, and I mean roving, Ryan Giggs. Now, Edward VIII, would have recognised, if not sympathised, with Ryan Giggs. Why? Because in the UK, back in the 30s, the British press observed a news blackout on the royal affair with Wallace Simpson. And that was thanks to a gentleman's agreement between the King, Lord Beaverbrook, and and the Newspaper Publishers Association. The American press, including the occasionally saintly New York Times, brooked no such deal, and their reporting helped to precipitate the abdication. Interesting parallel. Today, the transformational power of technology is altering our notion of the public realm and rendering media laws and practice obsolete. Again, this shift is not new, but it has crystallized in the wake of the controversy here in this country over phone hacking, now the subject of a police investigation and a judicial inquiry led by Lord Leveson. As I observed in this year's Cutlet lecture, the phone hacking scandal does mark a watershed, not just for News International, but also for tabloid journalism. The practice of phone hacking and so-called blagging for confidential information was widespread, and not only amongst the tabloids. The Information Commissioner's report in 2006, scandalously neglected at the time, showed that 305 journalists used private investigators, while more than 17,000 invoices or purchase orders were discovered. By the way, the FT wasn't on that list. Beyond the conviction of one News of the World journalist and one private investigator, a Mr. Glenn Mulcair, no further action was taken. Not by the police, not by the courts, and not by the Press Complaints Commission. On the contrary, the PCC belittled The Guardian's reporting, and the Metropolitan Police fluffed a chance to reopen their investigations in 2009. Most important of all, and it pains me to say this, the British newspaper industry itself did not take the story sufficiently, with the very notable exception of The Guardian. It took a foreign newspaper, The New York Times, to break fresh ground after an investigation lasting many months and several reporters. Aside, therefore, from a few lone voices, including the FT, no one dared speak the truth that self-regulation had simply failed. As for News International, executives repeatedly told Parliament and the police that phone hacking was confined to a rogue actor, the News of the World's royal correspondent, Clive Goodman, whose information was supplied by Mr. Mulcair. It now transpires that phone hacking at the News of the World was on an industrial scale, with targets ranging from film stars to football commentators, and most horrifying of all, of course, the murdered schoolgirl, Millie Dowling. By the latest count, the News of the World held the phone numbers of some 3,870 people. By what stretch of the imagination can such practices be justified as in the public interest? And why were the authorities and News of the World's peers so reluctant to challenge them? These matters will be examined, of course, by the Leveson Inquiry, but I would like to offer some theories tonight. It would be immensely comforting to justify this modern news blackout in terms of a centuries-old respect for press freedom in Britain. My own experience of libel threats and court injunctions, usually levelled by the rich and famous, suggests that that respect runs rather thin. The uncomfortable truth is that politicians, the police, and certain corners of the press have enjoyed too cozy a relationship, creating the conditions for a conspiracy of silence. Today, as I said last January, the political elite in Britain have all worked in or with the media industry. David Cameron worked in a TV company, commercial TV company. Jeremy Hunt ran a publishing business. Michael Gove was a newspaper columnist. Boris Johnson was a magazine editor and still writes a weekly newspaper column. Ed Miliband was a TV researcher. And last but certainly not least, Ed Balls was an editorial writer for the FT. It's quite a good one, actually. In the case of News Corporation, the relationships were especially tight, not just with the Metropolitan Police, but also with the political elite. And this, in turn, is surely linked to the preponderance of power enjoyed by the Murdoch Empire in Britain. Even without the News of the World, its newspapers hold 35% of the market, while B Sky B, in which it holds a 40% or near 40% stake, has more, just more, slightly more revenues than the BBC and ITV combined. Now, Rupert Murdoch and his colleagues have brilliantly exploited this dominant position, not just to make money, but also to exert a profound influence over public life in this country. Now, others may look upon this influence with indifference, a price, if you like, worth paying for the entrepreneurial flair which, it should not be forgotten, rescued the British newspaper industry more than 20 years ago. In this view, Mr. Murdoch is, in the words of Conrad Black, a great bad man. But the News of the World scandal should give us all pause for thought, not just because of News International's painfully inadequate response initially, it's got better now, but also because of the culture which bred such practices. The best thing now is for the mainstream media to clean house and set out new ideas to reform our self-regulatory system. The first contention, the first proposition is hardly contentious. The Press Complaints Commission in its current form is dead. Not because it's dishonest or unethical, but because it no longer commands public confidence. The PCC, whatever its qualities, and there are many, has shown itself in one respect, important respect, incapable, and that is incapable of regulating the media's barons. Whether or not that view is fair is irrelevant. So second, it's time to open up the bodies responsible for self-regulation, bringing in outsiders and reducing, if not eliminating, the role of insiders. Many of the remedies were put forward in a prescient report by the Media Standards Trust in 2009. For example, on the PCC itself, 9 of the members, excluding the chair, are lay members, while 7 are working newspaper and magazine editors. There are no independent members either on the Editorial Code Committee or the Press Board of Finance, all of which are occupied by editors or senior executives of news organisations. This system, in other words, is riddled with conflicts of interest. Third, the new body, call it the Media Standards Commission, that's my words, should be a regulator with intelligible statements of principle, measurable standards, and a clear mandate for intervention. It is time to build on useful work by the PCC. Real sanctions should include timely and prominent redress for corrections or adverse adjudications. On the other hand, the question of investigative powers is more problematic. Investigatory powers would be a serious weapon to combat wrongdoing, true. But it's important to distinguish between criminal misconduct, which is a matter for the police, and unethical or unprofessional journalistic behaviour. Any investigations, too, would require a fairly high threshold to be approved by the appropriate and independent committee of the new self-regulatory body. Otherwise, letting loose a trigger-happy team of investigators would be costly and open to abuse. Fourth, it is vital that the industry participates fully in the new system. The current PC system is dangerously close to a la carte. In future, all printed media should be encouraged to be full members and committed to making it work. There should be consequences for those who opt out, like Express newspapers from the PCC. That could take the form of a statutory levy on advertising revenues for non-participants, with such levies being used to fund the new body. That's only a suggestion. Should the new system embrace new media, such as the Huffington Post UK or individual political bloggers, such as Guido Fawkes? My answer is yes. not simply in the interests of a level playing field, but also because the distinction between old and new media is rapidly becoming meaningless in this new digital ecosystem. New media is moving into reporting. Old media is blogging and tweeting and using social media to promote and distribute news and analysis around the world. I think that's happening to my speech tonight, even as I speak. So we're all in the same system, and that's why we should call it the Media Standards Commission. Yet, this is important. With certain rights go certain obligations. As regards the content pirates, it's time they join the merchant navy. Wholesale copying of original content cannot be considered a legitimate journalistic enterprise. Even powerful aggregators such as Google have recognized as much, and others should now follow suit. Social media tactical partnerships such as between WikiLeaks and the New York Times, Guardian, Der Spiegel, as well as cross-media collaboration with new philanthro journalism outfits such as ProPublica or the Center for Investigative Journalism, underline how we are in a new world. It's not too fanciful either to imagine future partnerships between mainstream media and aggregators such as Apple, Google, and Amazon, each of whom have powerful distribution channels and stores of reader information, but remain at present wary of moving into the primary content business. So given this flux, we should be very wary about creating a system that licenses or defines journalists. By implication, such a system invests power in those who award the licenses, and Britain has no interest in encouraging efforts to license journalists internationally. There are plenty of self-styled democracies toying with or in the process of passing new media laws intended to curb legitimate journalistic endeavour, which holds power to account. And finally, in the absence of a First Amendment in this country, it's time for a serious debate about the public interest, which is still the primary defence of freedom of the press. Now, this is easier said than done. What is clear that such a definition must surely extend beyond the trope that the public interest is, by definition, what the public is interested in. Some restraints on free expression are, of course, necessary and are recognised by the press and media as being so. Protection of minors, matters of vital national security, for example. Mark Thompson, the BBC Director General, has argued correctly, in my view, that subterfuge may be justified in the pursuit of the public interest, but the bar must be set very high for any journalist to consider either breaking the law or appearing to be in violation of the law. The criteria for assessing responsible journalism pursuing the public interest were put forward by Lord Justice Nicholls in the 1999 case of Reynolds versus the Sunday Times. These included the importance of the story, the status of such information, the status of the source, the urgency of the matter, the steps taken to verify the story, as well as the tone of the article. Now, in some eyes, the Reynolds defence has been eroded by subsequent rulings in the UK courts and has become a thin reed upon which to rest a robust public interest defence in libel cases. Moreover, when it comes to weighing the importance of the right to privacy and the public interest, the European Convention of Human Rights has also tilted the playing field against the press. So there's plenty to discuss in this area.